Welcome to the Investing in Real Estate podcast with Clayton Morris. This is the show where we focus on buy and hold real estate. Why do we do it? We do it for the purposes of creating passive income and legacy wealth for you and your family. If you're interested in finding your freedom number, come over to our website at morrisinvest.com/freedom and download your free financial freedom cheat sheet today. Hey, everybody, welcome into another episode of Investing in Real Estate. This is the show where we focus on buy and hold real estate, creating passive income so that you can sit back and create legacy wealth for you and your family. The vehicle we use is real estate. I'm a longtime real estate investor and have rehabbed hundreds of homes, and I am thrilled to have a guest on today's show because at some point, things can get really complicated. You can get a little overwhelmed. You can get frustrated with real estate. Maybe it's even keeping you from taking action to begin with because it sounds so overwhelming. And even when you're a few years into the process and you're a real estate investor, boy, you can sometimes scratch your head, say, am I doing the right thing? Wow, we've got this many LLCs. We've got this software program. We're in over our heads. So today's episode is all about keeping it simple. And my guest today is John Schaub. John, nice to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Layton.
Well, John, you're down in sunny Sarasota, Florida. Am I right? Is that where you do the bulk of your real estate investing?
Well, that's why I do all of it now. I've been in 10 states over my career, but we consolidated back to Florida. We happen to live in a great place for real estate, and I've learned that keeping things closer to home makes my life simpler. So we consolidated everything into Sarasota at this point.
Well, John has had a successful career avoiding having a job since graduating from college. He's an active investor. He buys and manages his own investments. He has a best-selling book called Building Wealth, One House at a Time. It's now in its 15th printing, if you can believe that. And he's helped more than 100,000 investors start investing in homes. So I love that, John. Do you ever pinch yourself and say, my gosh, how have I helped so many people do this?
Well, you do it one at a time, like everything else in life. You know, you start talking to one person, and that leads to another, and get referrals, and the word spreads. So it has been a fun part of my life, though.
Well, we talk about keeping it simple. If you had to go back and talk to a younger John, what would you tell him now that you know how complicated things can get?
Well, yeah, the whole theme of my book is buying houses one at a time, and people who tend to get going too fast and overachieve sometimes take major steps backwards because they lose control, and sometimes they are invested with a lot of leverage and we have a downturn, so they get in a bad situation and lose properties. So I've always encouraged people to take a very conservative approach and to use leverage, but to use it wisely. Warren Buffett was just interviewed, and they talked to him about the secret to his success, and he said that rather than buying high-risk stocks for all cash, he buys low-risk stocks, and he leverages them wisely. And we use that same approach in real estate and have for over 30 years. We buy very conservative real estate investments, but we leverage them wisely, and we leverage them fairly highly many times, and that gets our rates of return way up. And in real estate, the math works out because you can buy a house with a 70 or 80% loan, and it'll have cash flow if you manage it well.
How do you manage it well?
Well, I manage it myself. I've delegated management to other firms from time to time and found they didn't do a very good job. So I delegate to my tenants now. I'm very picky about who I rent to. I buy a house specifically to attract a tenant who will stay a long period of time. And the key to my success as a manager is the longevity of my tenants. People stay with me on average of more than 5 years, close to 8 years right now. And I've had a number of people stay 15 or 20 years. And those people make you a lot of money because they move into a house and they stay there until they pay it off. And now you own the house free and clear and never made a payment. So it's a very simple strategy, but it works really well if you do it right. If you buy a house that attracts a good tenant, and then you take care of your tenants. You know, you raise the rents, but you don't raise them so much that they want to move. And you take care of the house so they enjoy living there.
Right. I mean, those are my favorite kind of tenants. You know, the five-year leases on properties, we do that a lot. What sort of things are you looking for in those tenants when you're screening for those tenants? To what things stick out to you that say, this person's going to end up staying for a long time?
Well, one of the first questions I ask people, Clayton, is how long do you plan to stay? So I just get right to the point. And, you know, a lot of people will say, well, we want to buy a house, or we're just here for 6 months. And they'll tell me a story that I want to hear. because I don't want to rent to them if they're only going to be there 6 months or they're going to buy a house right away. So I use a little common sense and in interview the process and ask questions. You know, you look for longevity and where they stayed before, looking for somebody who probably stayed someplace else for a number of years. And then you try not to rent to somebody who makes too much money, because if you rent to somebody who's making a lot of money, common sense will tell you they'll probably buy a house pretty soon or they'll move someplace else. So you're looking, there's a sweet spot in the middle where people have decent jobs, yet they like renting because they don't like the responsibility of home ownership and they don't want to take the risk of home ownership. So we assume that risk and we're able to provide a house at a very fair price to people who will stay long periods of time.
Hmm. What types of deals, you know, when you go back to the beginning, what was one or, you know, tell me about one of your first deals and how has that shifted over time for you?
Well, the first house I bought, and I still have it, I bought back about 40 years ago now, and I bought it from a fellow who was a car dealer. Now, when you think back about that, that's not the guy I would have chosen to buy from, but he had a house for sale. And I ended up buying it from him for about 20% down, and he financed the balance at 7% interest for 20 years. I didn't make a great deal on that house. I didn't buy it below the market. When I put 20% down, that wasn't a great deal, but the fact that I was able to rent the house for enough to make the payments and keep the house for a longer period of time, it's been one of my most profitable investments because it's gone up 20 or 30 times since I bought it. And of course, the rents are way up and it's been paid for 20 years now. So you look for investments that that a seller is ready to sell. You know, ideally, you want the seller to be more anxious than you are as the buyer. And that's hard when you're beginning because you're anxious to buy things. So kind of focusing on what you want to buy and know what price you want to pay. In the book, I talk about buying at least 10% below the market, and not putting more than 10% down and not making more than 10% interest, which seems high, but you'll see that markets for interest rates change dramatically. And there are people buying houses today and paying more than 10% interest.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. People are paying 12% interest in 2 points, you know, just to get involved.
That's right. Just to get in the market because the market's going up. So people will pay more than that. And you shouldn't. You know, if you're an investor, you have to be realistic about what kind of income a house or any kind of property will actually produce. And I've owned apartments and motels and commercial buildings, so I've owned a lot of different types of property. But you can be fooled by projections. You have to deal with real world numbers based on what the rental market is today. And what we've found over the years is the rental market in single family houses in decent locations is much more stable than the apartment building business or the commercial business. The vacancies in those areas tend to be larger and longer than we have in the house business.
Yeah, that's why I love single family homes. That's the bread and butter of my portfolio and of my business. Why do you think that is? Is it the, you know, I often hear the stories from people that just, you know, psychologically, it's an idea of when you're in a house, you mentioned the 5-year, 8-year tenants, they kind of take mental ownership of the house in a way, even though it's not their own home. They have a driveway, they have a backyard, maybe they have a pet. So they have, you know, and sometimes it's kind of harder to move when you kind of put down roots like that.
Well, yeah, I like to rent a house to people that have a lot of things. Back when I owned apartments and rented apartments, a lot of people would move in with just their suitcase. You know, they wouldn't have much, so it didn't take them much to move. But with a house, you know, if somebody has a house full of furniture, and all my houses have garages, and they all have double car garages, and I don't think I have a single tenant that parks in that garage. They just fill it up with stuff. And more stuff they have, I think probably the less likely they are to move. So it's a combination of a lot of things. But during this last downturn, you know, we had a real drop in prices in my town, 50% drop in prices. We had high unemployment because we had a lot of construction people who just left the state. And but with all that going on, 80% of my tenants stayed in place and I didn't have to reduce the rent. We lost 10% of our tenants. They just disappeared on us and moved to another state. And the other 10%, I adjusted the rent to keep them. But compare that to the apartment business or the commercial business, you'll see we did much better. And so our income is much more stable. And if you can just get that concept that because the income is stable and more safe, then you can leverage it. And I'm not saying leverage it to 100%, although one of my students, one of my most famous students, a guy named Robert Allen, wrote a book called Nothing Down years ago. And it's a good book. It's still worth reading. And the idea of buying something with 100% leverage is a wonderful thing as long as you can afford the payments. But you have to make sure you can afford the payments.
Well, I have to say it's a real treat having you here on the show because I've had a lot of people write to me, you know, over the past 2 years or so saying, you've got to get John on the show. you know, he's a legend. And I said, of course, I'd love to have John on the show. And so I'm so thrilled that you're here. I want to pick your brain about, and I'd love to have you come back and we could talk even deeper strategies on different strategies and different things you talk about in your seminars. But one of the things that always holds people back, of course, is funding and finding, you know, finding safe and affordable financing. How do you instruct your students to find and keep some of that safe, affordable financing that seems to elude so many people?
Well, I'll give you a little backstory here. When I started in business, I had a real estate license and I managed an apartment building. I had some income, but not a lot of income. So when I found that first house I wanted to buy, I couldn't qualify for a bank loan. So I found a seller who would finance it for me. And that was an important lesson to me because up to that point, I didn't know sellers would finance it, but I learned that they would. So from that point forward, I decided I wouldn't go to a bank. I would find either sellers to finance property for me, or I soon after that, found a couple of fellows who would invest with me. And when I found a property that made sense and was profitable, I could find some private money, individuals who would invest with me and put up the money for the down payment or put up for all the money if that's what it took. So those two sources have kept me away from banks. And I will tell you, to this point, and I've been doing it for most of my life, I have never gone to a bank to borrow money to buy a house and don't ever plan to because there are other sources. And the people have this breakthrough where they understand enough about the business to see that there are always people who are anxious to sell properties and they are willing to finance them for you. And in today's market, it's even better than it's ever been because the houses we're buying today, people are financing for us at 4%, which is a terrific rate. And the reason they're doing that is because if they take the cash and put the money in the bank, they're getting less than 1%. So I'm paying them four times as much interest as they get at the bank, and everybody's just delighted. So it's a remarkable time to invest in real estate for that reason. There are sellers who will finance for you at low interest rates and long term. People sometimes think because somebody's 75 or 80 years old, they won't invest for the long term, and that's a bad thought. They do. I've had several people in their 70s and 80s finance things for me for 20 years.
Well, and for sure. And because there's a whole other reason that they're doing it too. It's taxes, right? And they don't want to be hit with a big capital gains tax and having to go back on tax deferment or depreciation by unloading that property just in a straight sale. So it makes more sense for them to spread out that pain over a number of years.
Well, if they have a tax, you know, I buy a lot of houses from homeowners who are selling them, and they can take the first $250,000 out if they're single or $500,000 out tax-free. So many times taxes is not the biggest issue, but the income is a major issue for these people. If you write somebody a check for $200,000 and they put it in the bank at 1% and see how long that's going to last them, it won't be long enough.
Right.
And so if I will pay them 4 or 5%, they will see that their money will last longer than they will. And that's exactly what they're looking for.
Right. If you do some marketing to find some tired landlords that own 10, 20 properties and they're looking at liquidating, you know, and moving out of that business and they're willing to do seller financing, I've come across just so many, I can't even count.
Well, that's right. There's really an unlimited supply, and the timing's good because, I mean, there's so many people that have been investing now for 10, 20, or 30 years that who want to liquidate. So your point is very important, I think, that when you find investors, and one thing we found in our last class, when I teach a class, we actually go out in the field and we knock on doors and we look for properties for sale. And one thing we found in this last month is that there were many, many houses that were owned by landlords who didn't want to be landlords. They became landlords because they couldn't sell the property back in the, you know, 7, 8 years ago when the market was so soft. And all these properties are still for sale, but now they're rented. So it's a whole different opportunity, but they're all available for owner financing.
Right. A lot of people just ask that question. Well, why would someone be a motivated seller? Why would that person sell that house? You hit the nail on the head. You know, maybe somebody lives across the country and you know, a family member passed away. They inherited the property and, you know, it needed some updating. They don't have the money within their family to update the property. They end up sitting on it. They don't want to deal with it. And, you know, it's not in their family's business right now to own some little property in Florida that's kind of, you know, built in the 1970s and needs some updating. So that's a perfect candidate for someone who, you know, would be willing to sell that property. Today's podcast is brought to you by Realty Shares. And before I get into explaining what Realty Shares is all about, it's a great way for people that don't have a lot of money to get started with real estate investing. I have to read this required statement under the law. So here it is. It's not an offering of securities. Private investments are highly illiquid and risky and are not suitable for all investors. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Securities offered to accredited investors through North Capital Private Securities. It's a member FINRA SIPC. All right, great. Now that we got that legal disclaimer out of the way, I want to talk to you about what Realty Shares can do for you if you don't have a lot of money and you want to get started with real estate investing. I think this is a great way for investors who, let's say you have $5,000 and you qualify, now you can get started with real estate investing. You can basically work with RealtyShares.com. What they've done is they've demolished the walls between you and real estate investing. You no longer need billions of dollars or even tens of thousands of dollars to invest in actual real estate assets. What they've done is that they've brought hundreds of people together who invest fractionally in real estate. So you own a portion of the asset with your investment. So it reduces the cost of an initial investment. And then Realty Shares deals are vetted and curated by industry professionals who underwrite. And then they perform all the detailed due diligence. So you don't have to source any properties. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff yourself. All it takes is $5,000 to get started. There are no hidden fees. It's totally free to sign up. When I went through their website and went through the process of signing up, it's so simple to set up. And then you can just easily browse through investments that you want to get involved with. Getting set up just takes a few minutes. Then you can manage and invest straight from your phone or your computer through their simple and secure online process. So here's the deal. If you make $200,000 a year, you may qualify. All you need to do to get started, find out today, go to realtyshares.com/IIRE. That's our podcast, Investing in Real Estate. So you need to go to that URL, realtyshares.com/IIRE, and they're going to give you $100 towards your first investment. Just for coming over there. They're going to give you a free $100 just for going to that URL. But make sure you spell it correctly, because some people get realty and they think that it needs to, you know, they spell it wrong. So it's not reality, it's realty. That's Realty Shares, and it's spelled R-E-A-L-T-Y, R-E-A-L-T-Y, shares.com/IIRE. Get that $100 towards your first investment. It's a great way to even diversify the stuff that you're currently doing with real estate investing. Or if you don't have the cash to get started, all you need is $5,000 to start investing fractionally in real estate. Love them. Great. Go check them out. Thanks, Realty Shares, for your support of the podcast. Thanks so much.
Another thing you talk about in your seminars is building repeat and referral business. And, you know, it's so, I hear this from, you know, new investors all the time. They get so excited about that first property, or they find that first, you know, seller financing deal or whatever it is, but then they don't have a plan in place to continue that growth. Well, how do you teach that?
Well, a couple of things. If you're dealing with private investor money, and I don't believe that's where most people should start, because you need to really be good at what you're doing before you invest somebody else's money. You know, if you're not sure what to pay for a property, or you're not sure about what terms are really good terms, or you don't know how to manage a property, you shouldn't go out and invest your grandmother's money, because you may lose it. You know, you should learn the business first. But the second piece of that is that if there are sellers, and there are always sellers who are willing to finance for you, you should ever have an area. What I teach people to do is, you know, take a map out and circle four or five neighborhoods that you want to buy in, and then be specific about what you want to buy, what price range, what down payment, what monthly payment, what interest rate, and know what kind of rent you can collect on those houses. And then work those neighborhoods aggressively. And that's what realtors do. They what they call farm neighborhoods. They go knock on doors trying to get listings. And I'm not saying you do that, but what you do is you keep an eye on everything that comes up for sale, or everything that looks like it's in distress, or every time somebody's evicting somebody or has a house for rent, you call on all those signs. And it's a numbers game, but you know, if you'll actually make calls and talk to people, you know, maybe a dozen times a week, you're going to start finding deals on a regular basis. There is always a deal out there. It's just a matter of putting a little time in. But and the other side of it is being focused, you know, knowing exactly what you want to buy before you start looking for something.
Right. That's key. Having that goal. 3% of people write down their goals, and 3% of people are successful in this country. It's not a coincidence that when people actually map out their goals, they find success by staring at those goals, whether it's stuck on their, you know, computer screen or on their whiteboard or in their little diary that they carry around with them. We talked at the beginning here about keeping it simple and, you know, being efficient in your real estate investing. Where would you start, to sort of create that from the beginning? Because it's always harder to clean up your desk, you know, than it is to start with that clean desk, you know?
Well, you know, you start by not making a mess. Too many people get ahead of themselves. And as you mentioned earlier, they'll form LLCs or corporations and create a whole bunch of paperwork that now has to be maintained before they even buy one property. So start with buying the first property. I mean, go out and buy a piece of real estate. I don't care if you do it all wrong. I don't care if you put it in your name. All these things can be fixed, but learn the business. You know, start by buying one. My mantra is always have as few moving parts as possible. You know, if I could figure out how to do it, I would just have one house and one tenant and be happy. But you give up too much by doing that. You know, that one house would be a very expensive house and that tenant wouldn't make any sense. So we ended up owning dozens and dozens of houses, but we do it. I own probably a third as many houses as I used to, because over the years we have fine-tuned the process. And now rather than owning a lot of relatively inexpensive houses, we own fewer, more expensive houses. And let me clarify that, because it's important for people to understand this concept. I'm not saying that you should buy an expensive house, but I'm saying that over time, you should be buying in better neighborhoods. And better neighborhoods will have more expensive lots. I'm convinced it's the lot that goes up in value, not the house, in most cases. Now, right, there's exceptions. There's some very historic houses. But most of the time, if you're buying a normal house, if you look at what's appreciating, it's the land under the house, not the house itself. The house is wearing out. So by buying fewer houses and buying them fairly close to where you live so you can manage them yourself, you can keep things fairly simple, and your life will be better because you'll have less interaction with people. You'll have fewer tenants to talk to. You'll have fewer mortgage payments and tax payments and insurance payments to keep track of. And all this detail work, as you well know, is very important. I've talked to more than one person who's lost a house, a free and clear house, because they forgot to pay the property taxes. And, you know, you don't want to get so you're so busy that you don't remember to do the important things. Another one of my favorite things to talk about as far as simplicity is paying off debt. You know, the way most people pay off debt is they'll pay an extra $25 or $50 or $100 a month. And if they'll think through that process, and I just wrote an article on this, I'll post it on my website for people. But if you think through this process, when you do that, when you earn money, pay all the taxes that you have to pay, payroll taxes and income taxes and state and city taxes, depending on where you live, you don't have much left over to pay debt down. If instead of doing that, you go out and buy a house and let that house go up in value, as it goes up in value, you're paying no taxes on that increase. And over time, it'll double a couple times. One day you'll wake up and you'll have enough money from that one house to pay off a whole bunch of debt. Maybe your student loan debt, maybe your consumer debt, maybe you could pay off two or three other houses that you own. But it's a much more efficient way to pay off debt than trying to pay an extra $25 or $50 or $100 a month on your payments, because before you make those payments, of course, you have to earn that money, pay taxes on it, and you're just paying debt down with money that's left over, and that's not a very efficient way to do it.
No, but pulling the equity out of those properties, that's a fantastic way to do it. I mean, certainly a way, you know, a lot of our investors have done it. You know, snowball effect, be able to buy and acquire more properties. Mm-hmm. How do you do it? I mean, how would you encourage some of your students to do it with home equity lines of credit on those particular investment properties? As it, you know, pulling out that equity?
No, you know, I don't like to pull out equity. I like the equity to keep working. If I want more debt, you know, let's say I want to be $1 million in debt because I want to have $1 million in leverage, rather than borrow $1 million against property that I already own, I'll go out and buy new properties, and I'll have the properties that I buy support the new $1 million in debt, and I'll have them pay that debt back. That way, I'm not putting at risk any of the properties I own now. I own most of my properties free and clear. We bought the house we lived in for cash back in 1980, and we've owned it free and clear ever since. I don't think you should own everything free and clear, but certainly as a real estate investor, because there are cycles in this business, it is wise to own something free and clear, so that if you have a very bad day, you've got some place to live and an asset that you can sell or borrow against to get back into business. The irony is that when the buys are the best is when most people don't have any money. You know, talking about bank loans, when we have one of these recessions and prices drop way off, The reason prices drop way off is because people cannot borrow money to buy the real estate, and all the investor loans disappear. So people who are investors who want to buy at the bottom of the market can't get a loan. The banks just won't lend to them. So learning these alternate ways to borrow money, to finance real estate, and then kind of really knowing the market in your town gives you the opportunity to take advantage of these markets when they dip. If you'll study Buffett's book, you mentioned the word snowball. There was a book written about Buffett called Snowball, and it was a very good book. But he talks about how he makes most of his money actually just buying on the dips. I mean, everybody talks about the appreciation, but most of the time he's waiting for a big dip in the market, and that's where he buys in. And the real estate market's like that too. Although I think you should continue to buy a little bit every year, you should be prepared so that when we have these major downturns, you're in a position to buy more property.
100%. And we've talked about that on the show, you know, and we've had economists on here who believe that there is a downturn coming, and, you know, Harry Dent and others who believe the greatest sale, you know, in our lifetime is coming around the corner. So who's going to be able to benefit from that? It's having that cash on hand, or those places that, you know, that the money in place to be able to buy, in this downturn, to be able to maximize your portfolio. Where, you know, speaking of the market and just where you see things are going, I know that's something that you address and you write about, and it seems like you're passionate about it, at least, preparing yourself for these downturns, whether it's with rising interest rates or just market shifts. Where do you think things are going in 2017, 2018?
Well, interest rates are creeping up, and that really won't have much of an effect on the market, although it may encourage more people to buy. What has a major effect on the market is the amount of credit that's available. Interest rate could go to 8% tomorrow morning, and people will continue to buy real estate if they could get loans. In fact, if interest rates went to 8%, that would be a reflection probably of some inflation in the marketplace. Now, the question is, will we have inflation over the next 2 or 3 years? We have full employment pretty much across the country. Wages are going up because in order to hire somebody now, you have to pay them more money. It has nothing to do with the minimum wage. It's just if you want to hire a guy in my town to build a house, you have to hire him away from somebody else. You have to pay him more money to do that. So people are earning more money. People are getting more overtime. They're just earning more. And that is inflationary because it gets more money in circulation in the economy. And as that happens, there's pressure on the Fed to increase interest rates, which I think they'll continue to do. But at the same time, we have an administration who's really interested in stimulating the economy because that's his plan to pay back all this debt, is to have more tax revenue. So I believe that's probably going to be the short-term strategy, which should be inflationary. But if they keep the credit market loose, if we loosen up on regulations on banks and maybe the reduce some of the restrictions that Dodd-Frank imposed, which I think is very possible. It should reduce the limits on credit that we have today. More people will be able to borrow to buy houses. And of course, that's going to push prices higher. It might make it a little harder to buy, but it'll push prices higher. And then eventually there'll be a cycle because someday too many people will buy houses and they'll buy with too low a down payment and the market will soften up a little bit. You know, the employment market I'm talking about now, people will not make as much money and they'll overborrow like they tend to do. And then they'll lose some of these houses and we'll have foreclosures again. So it's a natural thing. It's just like gravity. These markets move around just like the tide goes in and the tide goes out, and comes back in again. That's what the real estate market does. So there will be a cycle. I've known Harry Dent for a long time, and we agree on some things, we disagree on other things, but cycles we agree on.
Well, he's predicting. You know, he was just on the show here, and you know, he's predicting this great sale coming here. So get your money ready, because
you know, there was an article by Mark Cuban, I think it was in The Economist this week, and it talked about he has half his money in cash right now, and so you're looking at a guy who's pretty smart who has half his money in cash. You start scratching your head and you say, maybe there's a reason, maybe there's a method there. And we certainly have significant cash reserves right now, getting ready for whatever's going to come next.
It is crazy though, isn't it, John? I mean, when you think about it, because if you look at the, 12 straight days right now we've had of record Dow Jones returns, 12 straight days. And it's been what Wall Street has been reporting, record numbers on Wall Street. And yet Cuban has half his money in cash right now because he sees something.
So who's smarter, Wall Street or Mr. Cuban?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Wall Street's a very emotional thing, as you well know, if you've studied the market. And you know, if it kind of grows on good news and bad news, and then we have there's optimism now. There's optimism. If that turns around, the market certainly can go the other way. But people are feeling richer. If you look at the money in retirement accounts today compared to where it was 10 years ago, it's almost doubled again. It's got to be, it was $25 trillion last time I checked. It's probably closer to $30 trillion now. But there's a ton of money in retirement accounts, and that's another piece that's driving this whole economy.
Hmm. Well, you know, you hear so much about, and you can learn so much from John at his seminars. I mean, he survived 8 presidents, 5 recessions, 3 major tax law changes as a full-time investor. So at some of your seminars, you do 2-day seminars down in Florida where you can learn from John face-to-face and go through a lot of the stuff that we talked about today. John, how can people connect with you?
The best way is through my website, which is johnschaub.com, johnschaub.com. And I only taught one seminar last year, so I don't teach very often, Clayton. I'll probably teach 2 this year, but it's a very small number of public appearances. But I have written significantly, and I recorded some courses. So we welcome, you know, we do our best to pass along the information that we've learned over the years to both my kids and to everybody else. Because I feel when we're all doing a better job investing, it kind of rises all boats. You know, it's good for everybody.
That's true. So check out John's books. We'll have links to all of this on our show notes page for today's episode, but links to books like Building Wealth One House at a Time. You've got to check that one out. Or Building Wealth, Buying Foreclosures, or Building Real Estate Wealth in a Changing Market. Just a few of the books you got to check out. We'll have links to that on the show notes page. John, I'd love to have you come back on. We can deep dive some more topics in a future, you know, maybe sometime over the summer and get you back on as we see where this market goes in 2017. Sound like a plan?
Sound like a great idea. I appreciate it.
Well, John, it's been a real treat having you here on the show. Wanted to be respectful of your time and get you out of here on time. Thanks so much, John. It's been a real pleasure having you here on the show.
Thank you, Clayton.
And thanks to all of you. And thanks for making this, we just got on Inc. Magazine's list of top business podcasts. So thanks to all of you for pushing us over that 3.5 million download mark. In such a short amount of time. We really appreciate it. And thanks for all of your kind feedback. We publish this show 3 times a week, as you know, and we will be back here on Monday with another great episode for you to dive into and to take action, become a real estate investor, because as John mentioned, when we're all investors and we're all helping each other, think abundance, we float all boats. So go out there, take action, and become a real estate investor. We'll see you next week, everyone.